From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines. And by the way, I've got an announcement for you. On August 31st, we will no longer be carrying XM Radio for Coast AM. Those of you who listen to us on XM Radio, take heed. You'll still, of course, be able to listen to the program on our 573 terrestrial radio stations. You can become a Coast Insider, and you can listen to us on iHeartRadio. But as of August 31st, no more on XM. It goes away. So trying to give you enough warning on that. I know a lot of you truck drivers listen to satellite radio. This one is going to go away. Here's what's happening. President Barack Obama defending what he called long-standing internet and phone monitoring programs as valuable tools to fight terrorism, saying that congressional lawmakers have been repeatedly briefed on the program and that judges oversee the program throughout. Nobody, he says, is listening to your telephone calls. That's not what this program is all about. As was indicated, what the intelligence community is doing is simply looking at the numbers and durations of calls. They're not looking at names and they're not looking at content, but they're shifting through this so-called mega data that may identify potential leads with respect to people that might engage in terrorism. He said the programs have been subjected to congressional and judicial review and approval. So they're all in on it. And here's some more. Monsanto, as we reported last night, the world's largest seed company said experimental wheat engineered to survive Roundup weed killer may have gotten into an Oregon field through an accidental or purposeful act. Monsanto said the U.S. Department of Agriculture is investigating how genetically modified wheat that hasn't been approved for commercial planting was found growing on an Oregon farm 8 years after nationwide field tests ended. Jeffrey Smith, the executive director of the Institute for Responsible Technology and a leading spokesperson about the dangers of genetically modified foods. Jeffrey, let me ask you first and foremost, how could this accidentally get into this Oregon farm field?
Well, once you plant a GMO outside, then the pollen does not read the signs. It can transfer to non-GM crops, which then be part of the gene pool, the background. And this can go on over and over again, year after year, and actually it's a permanent feature. So there's been over 50,000 field trials in the United States of over 100 different species. And so we would expect that many, many different escapes have occurred, and this is just the most recent one that's been discovered. And they can be costly, George, because already Japan has closed its doors to U.S. wheat exports, and so too has South Korea. And other countries are monitoring it by testing U.S. exports for this rogue, potentially dangerous, genetically modified crop variety.
Now, when they also say the possibility might not be accidental, but on purpose, what does that mean, Jeff?
This is just an excuse by Monsanto that maybe there was some sabotage that 11 years ago or 12 years ago when the last genetically modified wheat was planted in a field trial in Oregon, someone slipped it and saved some for 11 years and then planted it. It's actually a bogus claim. What happened was someone was spraying Roundup on their field to kill all of the plants, and some survived. And so they tested it and found that it was Roundup ready, and it was confirmed by the State Department. Now, the concept that it was on purpose, again, it's just a way that Monsanto tries to deflect the attention, especially this week after Connecticut passed the first state labeling laws requiring products to be genetically engineered to be labeled, and 2 weeks ago, more than 2 million marched against Monsanto in 52 countries, and there's been reports from the New York Times and others that the food companies are scrambling to get rid of genetically modified ingredients since they're so unpopular. So this has been an absolutely devastating couple of weeks for Monsanto and great news for the rest of us.
Very good, Jeffrey. Thank you so much. Richard Ramirez, a mass murderer and serial rapist, known as the Night Stalker for his 1985 crime spree in California is dead. They say he died of natural causes at the age of 53. Ramirez was convicted in 1989 of 13 murders, 11 in Southern California, two others in the San Francisco area. Among the five attempted murders, 11 sexual assaults, 14 burglaries. Ramirez, a professed Satanist, was dubbed the Night Stalker for his preference of breaking into houses in the wee hours of the morning. His attacks, many of them on elderly couples, terrified Southern California. We won't have to worry about him anymore, except his soul is still wandering around now on the dark side. The number of people in the United Kingdom who will get cancer during their lifetime will increase to nearly half the population by 2020, according to a forecast. People living longer is thought to be the major reason for the increase. A young man who drank a quart of soy sauce went into a coma, nearly died from an excess of salt in his body. According to a recent report, the 19-year-old who drank the soy sauce after being dared by his friends, not smart, is the first person known to have deliberately overdosed on such a high amount of salt and survived with no lasting neurological problems, according to the doctors in Virginia. The case was published online June 4th in the Journal of Emergency Medicine. Tens of thousands of people evacuated, some carried on the backs of rescuers or by boat, in Central Europe as heavy rainfall in the past week swelled rivers that spilled over their banks, flooded streets, businesses, and houses. News reports say at least seven people have been killed. Let's check in with our expert, Mitch Batras, EarthChangesMedia.com. Well, they're having problems over there too, Mitch, aren't they?
Oh, it's all over the world, George. Russia, Asia, it's happening everywhere. Well, we already know the cause. We know that we're in a cycle, a very severe cycle. And the Earth has seen it many times before, perhaps with less humans, I would suggest. But what really upsets me, instead of going over and over as to the cause, which is the Sun-Earth connection also related to the galaxy, the Earth is warming up, or Earth's core is warming up, is that we simply didn't prepare for it. Instead, we put all this money into this so-called global warming thing, and it's not about, having a cleaner world. Everyone wants that. But it was the money makers that really jumped in. Instead of funneling all that money into this make-believe global warming, we could have channeled the money into preparedness. I think it would be hard to find scientists to argue that we're in a cycle, and perhaps a very severe cycle. But we did not prepare for it. We didn't prepare on coastal areas. We didn't prepare for the rains. We didn't prepare for rising oceans. And this is the result.
Mitch, what's new with EarthChangesMedia.com? I know you have a lot of breaking stories that you post regularly there.
Yes, George. It's really coming together. Everything that you and I have been talking about over the years has really been spot on. In the last several months, the news releases coming out and the articles written in the scientific journals are telling the exact story what you and I have really always talked about. There's something going on in the galaxy. It's affecting everything, of course, our sun, and has a direct causal effect to the Earth and the Earth's core. The Earth's core is heating. Let's call it overheating. And as a way that it compensates for this overheating is through what's called convection. So a result of convection are these extreme weather events, earthquakes and volcanoes. So I've been extremely busy in tying that all together. Got a couple more pats on the back from some heavy-hitting mainstream scientists. That always feels good, the one from NASA. And we're monitoring that, and we're producing that and putting it up on our website, really on a minute-to-minute basis up at theearthchangesmedia.com.
Super. Mitch, thank you so much. You have yourself a good weekend, you and your family. How about a couple hours of talking about haunted objects, stories of ghosts on your shelf? That's right. Tim Iceberg joins us, and that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Spooky moments here on Coast to Coast. Sit back and enjoy. Tim Iceberg is an author, radio host, paranormal researcher known for his work on the unique haunts of New England. Tim tries to bring a journalistic approach to investigating the unknown. That's very important. He's the author of Ghosts of the South Coast and Haunted Objects, Stories of Ghosts on Your Shelf. And he hosts a popular spooky South Coast radio program as well. Tim has been featured on television programs such as Ghost Adventures, My Ghost Story, Monster Quest, and Most Terrifying Places in America. He is also the co-founder of Legend Trips, which is a paranormal events company which focuses on raising funds for historic haunts areas on coast to coast. Timothy, how are you?
Great, George. How you doing?
Good. Looking forward to this. How'd you get involved in the spooky side of life?
Oh, it kind of found me. As much as we like to think that we have control over the unknown, it kind of controls us. And it's been something that's been touching me throughout my entire life. And finally, about 10 years ago, I said, well, you know, if it's going to keep working its way into my life, then maybe I should just welcome it with open arms.
Super. And I trust you did that.
I did. Well, I'm still fighting it a little bit, but, you know.
Well, you sound like, and with your writings and your show, you really enjoy this. And I think that's important, isn't it?
Oh, I do. I mean, if you don't take the paranormal, you know, for what it is, which is something that's profoundly life-changing, once you realize that it is real and that it does happen, then it can drive you crazy. So if you can be accepting of it and you can walk into it with a sane mind and a logical approach, you'll find that it'll open your mind probably more than anything else.
Tim, you're in an area that is fraught with all kinds of paranormal activity out there in the south coast of the Massachusetts area in New England. Is that important to what you do? I mean, does it make it easier?
Oh, it definitely does. We're pretty much surrounded by the strange and unusual here. And it goes back all the way to when this area was first founded by the European settlers. And they realized that there were certain parts of this region that the Native Americans wanted nothing to do with. And when they found that the Europeans were settling in those areas, the Native Americans kind of just laughed at them because they had areas that they referred to as, you know, devil lands, devil swamp, cursed lands that they wouldn't go near. And here are the Europeans thinking this is a nice, safe place to set up our settlements. And from from the beginning, it seemed like these haunts were attacking us.
Tell me a little bit about the Lizzie Borden bed and breakfast area out there in Massachusetts.
This is probably for my money, the most active haunt in America. It is some place that to this day, you know, we have a murder that happened in 1892, yet still resonates 120 plus years later. And it's a case that will never be solved. And because of that, people go there day in and day out trying to find out more about the murders. And when they get there, they end up interacting with the spirits. And it was one of the first places that I investigated, and it's the place that I go to again and again and again, because each time it never disappoints. I always seem to make some sort of interaction with the unknown.
She was never convicted of those murders, was she?
No, she actually, she was not, and she was the only person ever brought to trial for them. And when the case, you know, fell apart for the prosecution, she still lived with that shroud of the murder over her for the rest of her life, no matter what she did. And she was a very generous person to the rest of her life. She gave a lot to children's charities and to animal charities, but people always kind of gave her the stink eye when she walked through Fall River society because they feel like, you know, like O.J. Simpson, she got away with murder.
Yeah, she was, in their eyes, she was guilty of sin. And I used to remember as a kid the poem of Lizzie Borden, which people would sing. And not that I was up during her era, but it was, you know, Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks. When the job was neatly done, gave her father 41. And they used to just sing that all the time. Do you remember that one?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And the funny thing about it is it was actually 18 and 11. But it doesn't matter because I'm pretty sure that the first one did the job in each
yeah,
case.
Yeah, I think so, too. Now, what makes that region so haunted, Tim?
Well, we have something here that's called the Bridgewater Triangle, which I know you've talked about in the past with Lauren Coleman, who actually
yes.
coined the term in the early 1980s. And it started off as a neat little triangle that involved three towns, East Bridgewater, West Bridgewater, and Bridgewater proper. And that was, you know, in the early 80s. Now, here we are 30 years later, and we've had to expand the borders of that triangle. And now it seems to encompass all of southern New England. And it's really just a paranormal vortex, a place where all kinds of strange and unusual activity takes place, from ghosts and hauntings to cryptid sightings to UFO and alien activity. and even strange little creatures like puckwudgies are seen throughout the area.
Now, in the Lizzie Borden situation, you've been to the house, haven't you? Anything strange happened there for you?
Pretty much from the first, actually not the first time I went. The first time I went, I left there saying, you know, this place isn't haunted at all. This is just all gimmick. And then I went back a few weeks later for an actual investigation, and my mind was just totally blown. Nothing was really happening in terms of activity, but when I decided to take a break in another room up on the third floor, a room that's allegedly haunted by two children who were actually murdered next door to the Borden house before the Borden murders themselves, I was laying on the bed, and in the course of trying to just take a rest, I could feel something picking my legs up and lifting me up off the bed. And that was just the beginning. That was kind of tame compared to what happened later.
Have you picked up some EVPs and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. We've caught Lizzie Borden herself, or so we believe, claiming that she was a good daughter and a crystal clear Victorian-era accent. We've also had some on the negative side as well. I've had EVP words sworn at me and called me not nice names. And we've even had incidents where we were growled at by something audible, but when we all played back our tape recorders, there was nothing there. So I don't know what it is. But my theory is that there's actually something that's a lot darker than the actual Bordens themselves, and this is something that thrived upon those murders and thrives upon everybody going into that house and talking about the murders.
Well, I was going to say, Tim, do you think whatever is there, this entity, may have contributed to the murders of the Bordens originally?
You know, it definitely could have, because when they moved into the house, they were a dysfunctional family for sure. You had the father and the stepmother, who the two daughters did not really particularly care for. And at this time, the daughters were both adults, and they were kind of making their own way in the world, and they were dependent on their wealthy father, Andrew Borden, to kind of help them take their place in Fall River society. And he was a little bit reluctant to be the eccentric millionaire type to throw his money around and to support his daughters. He wanted them to be very blue-collar and reflect those people who helped him make his money in Fall River. And so there was a lot of friction there because he wouldn't give them money, but yet he was giving his his second wife property that the daughters were hoping to get for themselves. So there was a lot of internal tension in the house already. So whether or not this entity fed on that and kind of just helped that along, or maybe it caused some of the more overt things that were happening. I mean, there's even rumors to this day that there was an incestuous relationship between Lizzie and her stepfather, and her father, Andrew Borden, that her stepmother knew about it. And a lot of people have come and said that, you know, there's no real proof of that. But there was one researcher who actually had some papers from the Borden family, some distant relatives that were communicating back and forth. And they certainly mentioned that as being the case in this correspondence.
Well, with Tim Weisberg, one of his books, Haunted Objects, Stories of Ghosts on Your Shelf. And what do you mean by ghosts on the shelf, Tim?
Well, you never know. You know, whatever you bring home and bring into your house could be carrying its own unique energy with it. And with that, there's the potential for numerous spirits. I'm a big yard sale guy, and I love flea markets.
Okay.
And I go out every weekend and try to find deals. And I'm probably finding just as many ghosts as I am good deals.
Let's talk a little bit about bringing these things home. How would people know? They wouldn't, would they?
Right. I mean, you really can't tell. I mean, some people, you know, have what's called the gift of psychometry, where they can hold an object in their hands and make a connection with whatever spirits might be attached to those objects, or even just the memories and the energies that are attached to it. But for the vast majority of us, we don't know what we're bringing into our house. And the general rule of thumb I tell people is that if it looks creepy and it looks like something that, you know, might have something attached to it, then it probably does. And if you have a problem with that, just leave it where it is. But if you're like me, you know, it's worth an extra couple of dollars if you think there's a good story to it.
Tim, have you had some truly creepy episodes occur for you?
Oh, certainly, especially in relation to haunted objects. I've had my own personal experiences. When my grandparents each died within a couple of years of each other, and then my cousin was living in their house, and the house burned down, my cousin was out safely. She had to jump from a third-story window, and she felt that my grandmother kind of carried her to the ground. But after the fire happened, I went to the house to try to find at least a little memento to remember them by. And I took a chair from my grandfather's workshop in the basement, And I took the ugly pink flamingo that used to be in his garden, which had half melted from the heat of the flames. And
yeah.
I said, you know, these are the two objects that I want to put in my room to remember them. And I would wake up at night and I would see my grandfather sitting in his chair, shaking his head. And over a series of a couple of nights, this happened, and I couldn't understand what he was trying to tell me. And then finally, on the last night, he pointed over to the pink flamingo, and I realized what he was trying to say. He wanted me to get rid of this memento of the actual damage.
Get it out of there. Tim, we're going to come back, talk a little bit more about demons and other stories on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Tim Weisberg, his author, of course, of Haunted Objects. We'll take calls next hour with him. Tim, let's get into demons for a moment. Have you come across people who truly believe that there are demonic forces out there?
I've definitely encountered people who feel that way, but I always had my own questions about whether or not that was really the case. I mean, we hear stories a lot of times about cases of mental disorders that are misdiagnosed by religious people as being a demonic possession, but I never really believed that there was these negative outside forces that were impacting humanity. Until I recently met a man with a story of his own haunted object. He had this chair that he was compelled to buy. It was an old horsehair chair from the Victorian era with gargoyles carved into the arms. A really cool chair, but something compelled him to spend more money than he could possibly afford for it. And he was consumed by thoughts of it until he finally went back and bought it. And then once he did, it had a profound effect on his life, and it just took over his every waking thought, and he would just come home from work and sit in the chair in the dark for hours and hours, and his life fell apart. His girlfriend left him. He had some substance abuse issues following this, and it just had such a hold on him that finally he realized that it was the chair. Something with the chair was affecting him, and so he actually moved. He left all of his stuff behind, and he just went to a new location. And when he took me to see this chair, he hadn't been there in 2 years, and it was the first time he laid eyes on it. But the way that he reacted when he saw this, it could only be, as far as I'm concerned, a demon that was somehow attached to this and was taking over his life whenever he was around it. The way that he would walk toward it and then take a few steps back, but then have to walk toward it again, and the look on his face and the change in his speech and the change in the way that he looked, I feel like I saw a demon influencing a person right before my eyes.
In St. Louis at the Alexis Brothers Hospital, the room where one of the original exorcisms took place that was based on the movie, it was with a little boy. And afterwards, Tim, they sold off some of the furniture. They got rid of the furniture that was in that room. You know, people took, you know, dressers and a bed and things like that. And I have heard that those people who bought those objects experienced horrendous hauntings. So I could see how these things could attach to stuff.
Right. I mean, even if the demon itself isn't attached to it, just the negative energy that was happening during the course of those exorcisms, trying to free that poor boy from whatever forces were attacking him, it's going to leave an imprint. And that's what happens with a lot of these objects, is it might be a benign item that might have, you know, no negative connotations with it whatsoever. But if it's around negative activity, it leaves its imprint on it.
Yeah, it sure does. Tell us a little bit about the things you've been working on, Tim.
Well, we've been collecting stories ever since the book first came out a year ago, with more stories of haunted objects. So, you know, at some point there might be a sequel to that. But lately I've been talking with a lot of people about spirit communication, and not just the average, you know, ways that we normally do it with Ouija boards and EVP and going to mediums, but some of these more interesting aspects of it to me include when you get the calls, phone calls from people who have recently passed away. And with today's technology, it's becoming harder and harder for the source of phone calls to be a mystery for the average person. I mean, caller ID and phone contacts and all that. And we've all got phones in our pockets all the time, so we're all susceptible to these calls. And I think that this is kind of the next way for the other side to reach out and touch us is through this technology. So that's kind of what I've been focusing on in terms of my writing. But lately I've been working on these legend trips events and getting people into these historic haunts, because there's so many places around New England that are paranormally active that people just don't have a chance to get into. So we found a nice way to get people in and experience these things for themselves while raising money for these locations to help with their restoration efforts.
Oh, that's great. And if people want to hear you on your radio show, how do they find you?
We're on SpookySouthCoast.com every Saturday night. We have our own little webcams in our studio where people can see what's going on, because for some reason people like to look at three guys talking into a microphone, but whatever, we have it there for you. And we have live chat there as well, and we take phone calls, and we always have a great time. I mean, we try to take things just as yourself. You know, we like to let the guests have their say. But at the same time, you know, we will challenge people if we feel that they're kind of getting out there. And we've never had anybody really come back and say to us, you know, I didn't like your approach. It's always very conversational, and it's always very non-confrontational.
What is it about hauntings, ghost stories that so many people are just obsessed with these days?
Well, I think it helps right now that the media has kind of latched on to it. It's become a nice little niche for television networks and publishers, and there seems to be more attention being paid to it. But I think part of it, too, is that's fostered an environment where people can feel more comfortable talking about these things with one another. I know that, you know, 10 years ago around the water cooler, I wouldn't want to share my ghost stories with just anybody in the office. I would really only share it with people that I was very close to, and after I had a chance to get to know them for a while, I would know that they wouldn't judge me based on the story I was telling them. But now that's changed. Now people will be willing to come up to me and talk to me about ghosts, not even knowing who I am, but ghosts seem to always work their way into the conversation. And if I stop at a yard sale, you know, I always have to ask people too before I buy something, is this haunted? And they always look at me funny, and I'm like, no, if it is, I want it even more.
Do you find that those people who believe in ghosts also obviously believe in life after death and the hereafter?
I think in general, yes. That still seems to be the predominant theory of what ghosts are, is that they are just the spirits of people who have passed on. But I find more and more, at least in my research, that ghosts could be something else. I'm really starting to believe more in the thought form theory. The idea of these tulpas that the Tibetans talk about, and the Philip experiment of the Toronto Society for Psychical Research in the 1970s, I think that we're creating ghosts. The more that we're talking about them and the more that we're accepting of them, the more that we are inventing them. So when people go to these haunted locations again and again and they talk about the ghost stories, there can't help but be a ghost that comes about from all this energy being put into it.
Tell me some of your creepiest stories out there, Tim.
Oh, I'd have to say, at least in my own personal experiences, I was at Fort Tabor in New Bedford, Massachusetts, mm-hmm. which is one of the few Civil War era forts around New England. And we were in a bunker that was three stories underground, dug out of the side of a hill. And we're in the dead center of this thing, and it's immense. I mean, it's like half the size of Waverly Hills underground. And yeah. We have this wind that's blowing in our face out of nowhere. And one of the psychics who was with us was telling us that they could see a little boy bending over in the corner and covering his head. And we thought that he was the spirit of somebody who was in trouble and was sent there for punishment. And when we're investigating, all of a sudden we heard this loud crash that sounded like the roof was caving in on us. And we actually recorded it on audio recorders, and you can hear it. It's just this thunderous sound, but there was nothing happening. There was no damage. None of the beams had moved. There was no animals up there or anything. And so we figured out that it was probably the phantom cannon fire from the cannons that used to be on the top of the hill. And when we realized that, it made sense that, you know, here's this young man ducking and covering because he knows that the cannons are about to go off. And that's when I realized that when we're in these places, we are definitely taking a step back into another time.
You tell us about the Haitian mask story.
Oh, this story is incredible, and it comes to me from a very trusted paranormal investigator. So I definitely take her at her word on this story. She moved into her dream house, and it wasn't under the happiest of circumstances. Her brother was sick with cancer, and she moved to this house to be close to him. But it was the house that she always wanted. And she decided that she wanted to have the Haitian masks that she'd always wanted to have hanging on her dining room wall. So she looked around on the internet, and she found some from Port-au-Prince, and she ordered them and had them shipped to the house. And from the moment she hung them on the wall, just bad things were happening. And everything from, you know, phantom noises, things falling over in the dark, the dog not wanting to go into the dining room. But it got progressively worse as time went on, to the point where her son and his friends, who were all military, and they were all there on leave, kind of just relaxing at this house, and they were drinking, as guys will do. And as they're sitting there drinking, their glasses are exploding in their hands from whatever this unseen force is. And finally, eventually, it got to the point where sinkholes were developing all across the property, inexplicably. They would just walk out the door and there'd be a 3-foot hole in the front yard. And it got to the point where the foundation of the house was being compromised and the people were being negatively affected by the forces that were there. And finally, this person decided to get rid of the masks. And so she contacted John Zaffis, who is a friend of hers, and she said, I got to send these to you and you have to put them in your museum because nobody else should have these. They're too dangerous. And they brought them to the post office and mailed them to John, but he never received them.
Never got them.
They're out there somewhere. They just disappeared, and they could be wreaking havoc on someone else.
Absolutely. Some unwitting suspect, perhaps, huh?
If it looks too good to be true, it probably is.
It probably is. You also look at curses, not just hauntings. What have you unraveled?
I think with curses, it's a little bit different because a lot of the times, people will tell you, you can't be cursed unless you believe that you're cursed. You have to believe in a curse for it to have power. But I don't know if that's necessarily the case because some of the objects that we've researched that have curses attached to them, the people definitely were unwittingly victims of this curse. One of the most fascinating stories I found was about a cursed fish doll, for lack of a better term. There was a gentleman who lived with his family, and his mother was old and ill, and he was expecting that he was going to inherit everything because he was the one that lived in the house and took care of her when she was sick.
Yeah.
And he was the real, just not a nice guy. And he kind of took advantage of his family all the time and kind of pushed his mother into being more sick rather than well. And so they found out later on that he was a fisherman, and he had encountered some of the Brazilian fishermen that are in the New England area, the Portuguese fishermen that are in the New England area, and he had turned to what's known as macumba, which is a Portuguese-Brazilian form of voodoo. And he had created this fish doll and put a curse on it and put it in an altar in the house. And that cursed item had affected his entire family. And it wasn't until they buried the object in the backyard that they finally got some relief from this curse. But then even then, it started to wreak havoc from 4 or 5 feet underground. So finally, they had to have a paranormal researcher come in and remove it. And he still has it in his possession. I think he was going to give it to John Zaffis. I don't know if he has quite yet, but he said that nothing happened once he got it. So to me, that is a curse that's intended for somebody in particular that didn't carry on once it was out of their possession.
As a paranormal researcher, are you concerned that sometimes you can get too close to this and it could rub off on you?
It does happen. I mean, I've heard stories from people that I know and trust who tell me, I've had attacks happen to me at home from things that I've taken home from investigations. But I always operate under the assumption of if I don't want it to follow me, then it can't. And I try to use that approach when I go into haunted locations or when I take any of these haunted objects into my possession. That being said, anything that's really haunted, I just keep out in the shed.
Yes,
I don't want to take too many chances.
I don't blame you. Robert the Haunted Doll, have you heard of that story?
The Robert is, as we like to call him, he's the rock star of haunted objects. He is definitely the biggest name when it comes to haunted items. And to this day, people still talk about Robert's rules when you go and visit him down in Key West and how you have to be respectful to Robert or else Robert will wreak havoc on you. And he does. I mean, I know people who have been down there to see him that didn't take those rules seriously, and they paid the price for it.
Now, who's Claire the doll?
Claire is a doll that I had the pleasure of making my own acquaintance with here in my home.
Great. Why'd you do that?
I'm not really that afraid of these items. I kind of wanted to experiment with one of them. So when we put the request out for stories for the book, one of the listeners to my radio show sent me a message saying she has a haunted doll buried somewhere in her mother's closet. And when she received this doll as a little girl, it came to her from a close family friend who had just suddenly found it in her house. But what she didn't tell this woman, Jill, is that when she found that doll, it was the source of all kinds of negative activity going on in her home. So she decides, well, what's the best thing to do with it? I know, I'll give it to an 8-year-old girl. And so she gave it to Jill, and it sat in Jill's room. And Jill was also a collector of music boxes. And at night, the music boxes would all go off on their own, mysteriously, and in unison. And she started to think that Jill was that Claire was responsible for a lot of this activity. But she knew for sure the night that they all went off again and the doll turned and looked at her. And it's a porcelain doll with one of those sewn-on necks, so there's no way the head can physically move. but it still did. It turned and stared directly at her. And that was the night that she put it in a Tupperware container, put it in the back of her mother's closet, and didn't look at it again for about 25 years when she sent it to me. And so I brought that doll into my home, and I had a few strange incidents. I was recording a video for the internet, and I got a little bit of strange disturbance in the video that had never happened before or since. We took her in to Spooky South Coast and had her with us during the show, and the same thing happened with our webcast. We got some weird interference. And then I had her in my home office, and it was the summertime, and the heat kept going up on its own. And I thought that was a little bit strange, so I pretty much assumed that Claire was responsible for that, and that's when she went in the shed with the rest of the haunted items.
Yeah, I was going to say, or you should have kept her in that Tupperware bin.
Well, you know, Jill decides to send me the doll. She doesn't send me the Tupperware container, too.
Ah, I mean, just the doll, huh? Yeah.
Yeah, but that... we actually brought Claire the doll to Lizzie Borden's for one of our Legend Trips events there. Claire, Jill came up from Georgia to come to the event, and we figured it was an easy way to return the doll to her safely. So we brought her with us to the Borden house. And while nothing overtly happened with her while she was there, we think that those children who haunt the third floor were happy to have another toy to play with for the night.
What have you concluded about all of this, Tim? What's happening?
I just think that we're in a new era of interaction with the paranormal. I think that this is probably the way things were long ago, before the Enlightenment and before we decided to put aside mythology and put aside legend and lore and try to look at things more scientifically. I think that we've got away from being able to be open to the paranormal. And some people point back to the spiritual shift of 9/11. Some people point to the fact that we are a little bit more enlightened in our thinking now. But there definitely seems to have been some sort of switch that's been turned on. And now for the first time, the paranormal is staring us right in the face, and we just have to choose whether or not we want to look.
And are you convinced there are certain regions on the planet that might be more haunted than other spots?
I think so. I think that there's a certain factors that will allow for hauntings, for example, to be a lot more stronger in certain areas than they are. Of course, we have the Bridgewater Triangle, which I mentioned earlier, but there's also there's a triangle up in Maine. There's the Bermuda Triangle, the triangle that started it all. So there are these areas where there is more of a concentration of paranormal activity, and where maybe the veil just gets a little bit thinner, whether it's geological factors or just other scientific explanation behind it. Sure, that's part of it. But I think once we start accepting that these areas are different and unique and paranormally active, I think that we're also giving it power, and that's what really allows things to come through.
Tim, did you ever come across a real heartwarming haunted or ghost story? Because they're not all bad, are they?
No, they're not. And I just seem to be the guy who ends up walking into the ones that are bad.
Yeah.
I think it's, and that was because of my investigative approach. And I'm very confrontational, and I try to get the spirits to interact with me, and I'll be a little bit forceful in order to get what I want on an investigation. But I definitely had my mind changed recently at the Houghton Mansion in North Adams, Massachusetts, where that approach wasn't working for quite a while throughout the course of the investigation. Even though we were having activity take place, we were seeing shadow people walking right by us in the dark, standing there and staring at us. So we knew that there was a presence there. But I could sense that whatever it was a little bit hesitant with me and my investigative style. So I changed things up, and I kind of offered myself openly, and I held out my hand and offered to shake hands with this spirit. And I could literally feel a hand wrapping around mine and begin pumping my arm up and down.
You cut a deal with a spirit.
I did. And I'm not too proud to admit that I cried. You know, I had tears coming from my eyes, because that's when that made the connection to me that, you know, this could very well be another person that's just in a different form, but it's definitely another intelligence one way or another. And I can have that kind of connection with it. And it just changed me as an investigator. And now I don't really go in there, you know, talking about the negative things so much anymore.
All right. Well, stick with us, Tim. We're going to come back in a moment here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll take phone calls with you next hour. We'll be back.